Please be seated.
Can you all hear me outside?
I'll try to speak loudly enough that you can.
So I'm Brian Nystrom. I'm the assistant priest at St. John's Episcopal Church in Jackson. The Chapel of the Transfiguration is part of St. John's Parish, and I'm so happy to be with you all here today. Our rector, Jimmy Bartz, and I, we often, early in the week, we take a look at what the gospel reading, what the other readings might be, and sometimes we have conversations about, you know, how we're going to preach, what we're going to preach, and sometimes we don't, but because we don't often preach at the same time. Jimmy's preaching in town, I'm preaching up here. Anyway, this week Jimmy asked me, if we're going to read this story of David, Bathsheba, and Uriah the Hittite on Sunday, how can we possibly not preach to it? My knee-jerk reaction was, how in the world can I preach to this story? I mean, supposedly David was Israel's greatest king, and here we have a story of him acting despicably. Though the Hebrew scriptures tend to pull no punches, you know, they show the leaders of Israel to be fully human, fully fallible. This story seems particularly harsh. Here's what William Dierkiewicz said about David. David comes to us in 1 and 2 Samuel as a headstrong youth, a soothing minstrel, a hunted outlaw, a brutal warlord, beloved friend, divine poet, ecstatic dancer, despised husband, sexual predator, master politician, august ruler, grieving father, and dying king. A man in full, a matchless hero equal to every occasion, and yet, although, or perhaps because we see him in so many roles, we somehow never get a complete picture of him. His story in the way of biblical narrative is often fragmentary and elliptical, marked by contradictory accounts, terse notations, motives left unstated, gestures and phrases whose meanings we've lost. Trying to grasp him, we embrace a vapor. Like every true dancer, he is a figure of constant change, vivid, elusive, unforgettable. I would add to that, in today's story, nearly unforgivable. The story begins in a somewhat offhand fashion. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go to battle, it's what kings do, apparently, in the spring of the year. But this time, David stayed home in Jerusalem. He must have felt way too important to put himself in harm's way. Besides, he had armies of young men to do that, to do the killing and the dying, to do the dirty work for him. And besides, kings apparently had more important things to do on a spring afternoon, like taking a nap and then going for a stroll on the roof to survey their kingdom. It's a perfect image, right? The king on the roof looking down on all that he governs, that is, on all that he owns. And what does David, the king of Israel, see from the roof of his house? What does he see, one of his possessions that belongs to him by virtue of his high position? He sees a woman bathing. And he sees that she is beautiful, and he wants her. And because he is king, he can have what he wants. Whatever he sees is his for the taking. In fact, maybe he doesn't even need to take it, since it already belongs to him. Now, you might see that I'm saying it, but of course the object of David's gaze, the object of his desire, is not an object, not an it, but a person, a woman. And she was beautiful. So David asks around and finds out that this beautiful woman has a name, Bathsheba. But is she even a full person in this story? Only insofar as she is in relation to the man already in her life. She has a father, Eliam, and she has a husband, Or maybe it's more correct to say that her husband has her. But at any rate, her husband's name is Uriah the Hittite, and he is one of the 30 best soldiers in David's army. In today's story, granted, Uriah is treated very badly by King David, and in true biblical fashion, it's the men that the story focuses on. And we'll get to Uriah and David in a minute, but first I want us to keep our attention on Bathsheba, because she deserves our attention, because David rapes Bathsheba. The text reads, "So David sent messengers to get her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Then she returned to her house." Some people might be tempted to blame Bathsheba for what happened to her. In fact, that has been a very strong piece of the traditional interpretation of this story. It kind of goes like this. She was just too beautiful. She was just too seductive. David couldn't help himself. What was she doing bathing on the roof anyway? It's scandalous. Well, I'm here today to say that that interpretation does not stand. The perpetrator of sexual violence is the only one responsible for the crime. The victim of sexual assault is never to blame, period. Richard M. Davidson put it this way. Just as intercourse between an adult and a minor, even a consenting minor, is today termed statutory rape, so the intercourse between David and his subject, Bathsheba, even if Bathsheba, under the psychological pressure of one in power over her, acquiesced to the intercourse, is understood in biblical law, and so presented in this narrative, to be a case of rape. What today we call power rape, and the victimizer, not the victim, is held accountable. King David sent armed guards to bring one of his subjects into his bed. In every civilized country in the world, that is considered rape. The author of 2 Samuel doesn't tell us the trauma that Bathsheba might have experienced. And as a man who has never been sexually assaulted and never has needed to worry about being sexually assaulted, I'm in no position to speak to the pain, the shame, the degradation, whatever else Bathsheba might have gone through as a result of what she experienced. The odds are, though, that at least one in four of the women in this room could speak about the trauma of being sexually abused. Now, I pray that I have not triggered any trauma in anyone in this room today by speaking openly about this. If I have, I apologize. I pray for your forgiveness for me. But I feel that it's important to acknowledge and to call out rape, murder, incest, all abuses of power when our lectionary brings them up to be read in church on Sunday. I mention murder because that's on the horizon of this story too. First, though, David does the next wrong thing. When David finds out that Bathsheba is pregnant with his child, he does what any narcissistic, power-mad king is apt to do. He attempts to cover up his crime. He sends for Uriah. Bring him back from the fighting. He'll surely want to sleep with his wife while he's home, thinks David, and then I'll be off the hook. Everybody will assume that the child is Uriah's. But Uriah is a stand-up guy. He says, "No, my comrades are still in the field, fighting and camped out. I'm not coming home to be at ease while they are suffering." So he camps out on the king's doorstep. And David doesn't know what to do. So he does the next wrong thing. He gets Uriah drunk, thinking that that will break down his resolve. But no, Uriah, ever the diligent, competent soldier, ever the loyal and respectful one, the dutiful one, even when he's drunk, he refuses to go home to his wife. That was a bad move, because by not going home to Bathsheba, he seals his own death warrant. If he'd gone home and slept with his wife, even once, he might have lived. Of course, we have no way of knowing that. He was a soldier, after all, and he lived always with the possibility that he might die. But David wanted to make sure that he would die. What, out of spite? Just to get him out of the way? Again, the author of the story doesn't speak of psychological motive. He simply tells us what David did. He sent Uriah back to the war, sent a letter with him, addressed to the commander of the army that said, "Set Uriah in front of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die." David, what a guy. In this story, he's not a sympathetic character. And I wouldn't ever stand up here and tell you that David was an example of a man whose behavior or character we should aspire to. Most of the rest of the book of 2 Samuel goes on to tell the story of how God punished David for what he did, of all the terrible things that befell him and his family and those he loved as a result of his treatment of Bathsheba and Uriah. He treated them, you see, he treated them as if they were objects, not people. And he used them for his own pleasure and his own power, and that is perhaps the best definition of sin that I can think of. Treating others as if they were objects, as if we owned them, or manipulating them in a way that gives us power and ownership over them. I'll call that sin rather than moral wrong, because morality is a set of man-made rules, and granted, David breaks all the rules in this story, but the sin lies in the fact that he violated their God-given natures, that is, their sacred beings as children of God. That was David's great sin, and he spent pretty much the rest of his life paying for that sin. And I suppose that if there is any kind of message that we can glean from this story that is relevant today, July 29th, 2018, Grand Teton National Park, it is that all of us, like David, are apt to sin in exactly this way, because we are human. Along with our God-given humanity comes our God-given free will. And the easy choice to make, the seductive choice to make, is not always the loving choice. We live in a culture and in a world where self-regard and self-promotion are highly valued and often rewarded. We live in a time when behaving like David is so easy, especially for those of us who, simply by having been born into an economic class or race or gender, are born with a measure of power and privilege denied to others. We might need to be so careful not to fall into the trap that David sets for himself. And try as we might, sometimes we will fail. To borrow a phrase from Jimmy, don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that it is ever a valid excuse to say, "I couldn't help myself. It was too seductive. I'm only human." Although it is always true that we are human and fallible, that never makes it right to treat others as objects or as pawns in our own games. So here's the good news, which is what I always want to get around to and try to always get around to sooner or later. And it may be hardwired into us to default to our basest instincts, but there was a man who came from God 2,000 years ago who showed us a different way to live. Jesus fed, healed, and comforted those people who were the most vulnerable and the least privileged, and he calls us 2,000 years later to do the same. David had all the worldly power and used it in thoughtless, selfish ways. He made Israel great, but at what cost? Jesus repudiated all earthly power and taught that love and compassion bring salvation to a broken world. It is my prayer that we follow Jesus' way, not David's way. Jesus' way is the harder way, but it is the way of love. Amen. Amen.